Is it time for a mind shift? If you don't know what that means, then join your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, a former evangelical Christian pastor and Bible college teacher of over 20 years, along the journey of deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, life, religion, and spirituality.
I am so happy to be welcoming Stephanie McCown, author of the book Raised Evangelical. And that's very clever because it's R-A-Z-E-D, and I'm sure we'll talk about why you titled it that way. But it's called Raised Evangelical, Losing My Faith and Finding Myself. So welcome to Mindshift Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
I know we've been chatting on Twitter about getting into this issue of rapture anxiety, but then as we've been talking before we hit record, we obviously have a lot in common because I was reading through the first couple chapters of your book and it struck me that I just started jotting down some things that jumped off the page at me. And I thought, man, this is very similar to my own story. So I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about in terms of our background.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So you were raised evangelical. Can you give us a little sort of maybe a thumbnail sketch of your story growing up?
I was raised primarily in the Assembly of God Church, but before I ended up there, I was born in church, pretty much. You know, my grandparents were pastors. My parents met at Bible college. I don't remember there ever being a time where church was not a big part of my life. And when I was younger, you know, like little, like 3-4 years old, it was fun to me. You know, I remember happy songs and feeling loved because when I was little, we went to the church that my dad's family went to. So when I went to church, I was going to see my aunts and my uncles and my cousins, and it was just a very loving atmosphere. And then we moved, and when I was about 5, somewhere in there, that's when I started feeling the heavier emphasis on sin and so forth. And then when I got older, we moved again and ended up in an Assembly of God church. And then it was like every negative experience I had prior to that went into overdrive because the Assembly of God church was just so, you know, as we were talking about before you started recording, and there's a lot of emphasis on peace and freedom and, you know, what a joy it is to serve the Lord. And I'm like, I'm not having any of that. You know, I have nothing but stress all the time. Right. And it was a horrible, horrible experience that I was honestly very lucky to have lived through because there were, you know, I had untreated mental illness as a teenager. I was severely depressed all the time. And I was just told, you know, read your Bible and pray more and you'll be okay. And, you know, I was lucky to, I'm lucky to be alive, honestly, because I look back on it and just the pressure cooker I was in all the time. And I don't know how I survived it. And it certainly wasn't because I had God. I'll say that. It wasn't because Jesus was helping me or anything. I mean, it was just a sheer act of will that I did not throw in the towel because nothing I was being told back at that time was conducive to a full and healthy life. So,
this is such an ironic statement, isn't it? Because if you look at it, step back and look at it objectively, you say, okay, Christianity claims to represent the God who is the creator. He created the universe. He created us, humanity. Of all people, of all beings, he should know us intimately better than we know ourselves. Isn't that what the Bible says? So why is there this system then that produces such shame and anxiety and guilt and all these horrible feelings if it's truly from God? You know, I suppose you could turn around and say, well, that's the fault of humanity. They've twisted it. It used to be something pure, but then now it's something unrecognizable. But where's God in all that?
Right. Even back then, even when I was, you know, I considered myself an evangelical, that never made sense to me because it's like, but God makes the rules. He doesn't have to make it this hard, but he chooses to. Yeah. So it's, you know, that never... And, you know, people would say things to me like, well, the Old Testament God was angry and vengeful and so forth, and then his wrath was satisfied by the blood of Christ. And I'm like, okay, but isn't that a problem that it had to be satisfied by the sacrifice of his son? I mean,
it's so bad.
Yeah.
God had to die.
Right.
So gratitude and love because of that. That was something I always had a hard time manufacturing, a feeling that I was supposed to love God, you know, because of what he's done for me. I suppose like a worm, I should feel grateful for the fact that he saved me and he sent his only son to die in my place and all that.
Yeah. And, you know, even I've been out of the evangelical church for a few years now. And even still, to this day, I think about that stuff. And I thought, man, that is just so messed up. Mm-hmm. And it's a really, it's a process when you've lived with that mindset your entire life that, you know, a person who sets up an abusive system is someone you should also be grateful to for not abusing you worse than they do. It's really hard to get out of that mindset and to understand that that was an unhealthy thing that we were taught was normal. Yeah. And, you know, it led to a lot of bad decisions on my part because I had no idea what a healthy relationship looked like. And, you know, I've been single for a really long time because I'm only just now beginning to understand what a healthy relationship can be. Because I had no concept of that. Because I was always told that what love looks like, whether it's a romantic relationship or a friendship or anything, one person has all the power and the other person is grateful just to be in their presence and not be hurting worse than they are. You know, that's kind of what evangelicalism teaches. And it takes a lot to undo that.
Well, I was just talking to Dr. Marlene Winnell. She's written the book really on religious trauma syndrome. And one of the things I learned from her was that I posed the question, what's so bad about religion? Isn't it a good thing? You know, is it benign at best or helpful or benign at worst, helpful at best? And she started going through this checklist. She said, actually, let's talk about how pervasive religion is. It is all pervasive. It affects every single aspect of our lives, the way we see ourselves, the way we see others, our relationships, everything. And then when you disentangle from that, it's incredibly difficult to do that because, you know, looking at you and I, we were second generation. So we were both born into it, raised in it. So as far as I was concerned, I believed it was all absolutely true from day one. Because my parents were telling me, the pastor was telling me that this was the truth. I just believed it.
Yeah.
I didn't have any capacity for critical thinking. So I don't know how you feel about disentangling, but it's really difficult.
It's incredibly difficult. And I think people who were not raised in it, look at the experiences we've had and the things that we believe. And I've had people say to me, how could you ever have believed that? And it's like, well, that's all I knew. You know, I was raised in that. Yeah. I mean, when that's all you know, of course you're going to normalize it. You know, you were never told differently. So coming out of that and making the conscious effort again and again and again to disentangle. And every time those thoughts come into your head about, I don't have any value. You know, if someone's treating you badly, you think, well, I must have done something to deserve that. I mean, there are so many, you know, it's like a domino effect of consequences of being raised in that. And, you know, it is work to disentangle. And I think it's a lifelong process. I don't think anybody that I've ever spoken to who comes out of that has ever gets to that point where they're like, okay, I'm done. You know,
you don't just flip a switch and go, okay, that's me done and I'm fine now. I was chatting with somebody on Twitter the other day. She's an ex-evangelical as well, coming out of this kind of similar experience. And she was responding to someone who messaged her, and they said, you know, why can't you just move on? Why do you have to sit there and trash the church and trash Christianity? Can't you just let us get on with our lives? You get on with your lives. And she responded, she said, you know what? I would, except for the fact that the church is still doing incredible amounts of damage. That's why I'm speaking out, because, you know, going through your book, this is the other aspect of it too. When you put a young child who doesn't have the capacity to think these things through and process. I made a list of some of the stuff that jumped out. I mean, you talk about guilt, feeling guilty from that concept of original sin, shame because you were dirty, you were sinful, you were wicked, in need of salvation. We need God to save us from our sins. You said salvation is a product of shame and fear. It's not something that's rooted in love. There's this fear of hell. You have anxiety, you have depression. You're not supposed to trust your own heart, your own mind. Your heart is wicked. It's sinful. How are you supposed to discern God's will? Oh, just read the Bible. Well, that doesn't work. Pray more. Okay. That doesn't work. So you're in this really dysfunctional system as a young kid, and you come up out of that. That affects us on huge, deep levels, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It really does. And it, you know, it amazes me the way it reaches into so many aspects of life. You know, we talked briefly about relationships, but even, you know, choosing a job, choosing a career, should you go to college? You know, this was my struggle when I was in high school and I was still deeply evangelical, having been told Jesus is coming back soon. Well, then the question was, well, should I go to college, or should I be focusing my efforts on trying to save people? Is it sinful for me to want to pursue something just because I want to do it? If you haven't been immersed in that culture, especially from childhood, you have no concept. But for people who have been there, I mean, it's like that there's tendrils of evangelicalism that just reach into every part of your life, and it's shame and it's guilt and it's uncertainty. And it's the feeling, I felt like no matter what I did, it was going to be wrong, you know, because when you're told you can't trust your own heart, how can you make a decision and feel confident in it? And so that really paralyzed me for a long time. And now, you know, I'm 44 years old. And because of the decisions I made or didn't make when I was younger and still really deeply invested in that belief system, I'm now reaping the consequences of that because, you know, I just don't have a lot to fall back on. You know, I'm renting a place from my parents. So even though I would love to be disentangled from all of that, you know, they live right upstairs. And so I have to constantly run interference between them and my son because they try to indoctrinate him. And I'm like, you're not doing it.
Right.
You're not
so
doing
still
to him.
In the system.
They are. And it's been hard. But, you know, because I didn't make really solid decisions as a younger person, now I've got a child of my own that I'm raising by myself. And I just, you know, it's hard because I did not plant any seeds for the future because I was told there wasn't going to be one. And I believed it.
You didn't need to. Yeah, Jesus is coming soon.
Right.
Don't go to college. Don't waste your time because, yeah, as you said, we were better off out evangelizing and winning as many souls to Christ before the end inevitably comes, which is going to be pretty soon.
Yeah.
It's so true. And yet, it affects every area of our life. It's just unbelievable. And I think that in answering that question about the lady that I was tweeting with, why don't we just be quiet? Because it's still ongoing. We're still working through these issues from our past. You can't just snap your fingers and be over it in 2 seconds.
Well, when you see someone perpetuating the harm, it's incredibly difficult to just sit there quietly. I commented on something Franklin Graham had posted, and you could pick any number of his posts. I mean, he's always blowing smoke up his own ass, but you know. And I said something about he was capitalizing on some tragedy, as he usually does. And I was like, "Why are you doing that? Why are you using this opportunity to push your own evangelistic agenda here? Just let people grieve." Oh, it was after Kobe Bryant died, and he was saying something about how important it is to be ready at every moment, and et cetera, et cetera. And I'm like, dude, this is not the time. And somebody asked me, well, if you've left evangelicalism, why are you here? You know, so I guess you haven't really left it. I said, oh, I've left it, but I'm also standing in the doorway for people who are trying to find a way out. And I'm here letting them know there is a way out. That's why I won't leave you all alone.
You know? Yeah, so much going on. Well, look at the situation just with Samaritan's Purse.
Oh,
building the tent hospital in New York City right now for the coronavirus. On the face of it, that's an amazing thing. A charity is stepping up and doing an amazing piece of work. And then you hear what's on the back end. Oh, they want Christian nurses, Christian doctors. If you volunteer, you have to sign basically an anti-LGBTQ statement. Mm-hmm. Why? Why can't you just help out, for God's sake? And so that becomes another example of what you said. Why can't you just do some good? Why do you have to attach all this other bullshit to it with your toxic, you know, theology?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think, at least in the church I grew up in, because I think about that a lot, you know, because I look at some of the people that I looked to as mentors and stuff when I was younger, and they're good people. but there was always an agenda. Mm-hmm. It was never doing good just for the sake of doing good. It was always an agenda, and there's a strong emphasis on saviorism. And I think that, you know, they'll never say this, but I really believe that a lot of evangelical Christians, and I am going to specify white evangelical Christians because I don't see this as much from black evangelicals, okay? Mm. But I do see a lot of white evangelical Christians thinking it is their job to not just do what Jesus said, which is feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and so forth, but to really convert people to their way of thinking. And they see themselves as the savior. Jesus is like a byproduct. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know if that's making any sense, but it's like they're not looking to win people for Christ. They're looking to win people over to their way of thinking. Mm-hmm. Because if, like with Samaritan's Purse and their hospitals, if all they were really interested in is bringing people to Jesus, there are a lot of LGBTQ people out there who follow Jesus, mm-hmm. you know? So it's more about converting people to a very specific way of thinking, and which leads into, I was also raised to believe that a theocracy was the way to go, you know?
So you were into dominion theology.
Yeah. I mean, they would never come right out and say that, but we were always told, you know, who we should be voting for, which businesses we should be supporting, and so forth, based entirely on whether or not that person claimed to be a Christian. Mm-hmm. Didn't matter if they actually lived it. It mattered. What mattered was, would they advance a political agenda that would favor Christians? Mm-hmm. And if they would do that, then that was the person you voted for. Those were the businesses you supported, and so forth. So, I mean, it's all very entangled, but winning people for Jesus, like being Jesus to people, is not the goal at all with a lot of these people.
Well, and I think your example is a good one, because I've done a lot of talking recently about Christian Reconstructionism, dominion theology, the family, and all that. And it's a good example of how their talking points have filtered their way down into many evangelical churches. They might not say, yes, we're part of this Christian Reconstructionism or dominion theology. But they're still, as you say, they're advancing their agenda by voting for pro-Christian, pro-life, whatever, political candidates, and supporting these agendas. They're actually helping them get to this theocracy. So even the political side of it, you can't, as you say, disentangle yourself from that either.
Yeah.
It's all pervasive.
It is. And it blows my mind, because I'm the only person in my family that does not vote Republican, that does not support conservative politicians or agendas or anything. And I hear my family members talking about, you know, like my son said to me last night, he's like, Mom, I'm really confused about something. And I'm like, okay, what's up? And he said, well, my papa said that Donald Trump did something about the coronavirus as soon as he heard about it. And then if you're saying otherwise, it's because you're lying or you're listening to the wrong sources. And I'm like, oh my God.
Fake news. But, you know,
I know, but it's like the whole, not just Donald Trump, but that whole ideology has on them is when you're out of it and you look back on it, you know, and you observe people engaging in it, it's like, what the hell? I don't understand it, you know? Mm-hmm. But then I have to think, well, okay, but I was there too at one point. And it's because when you just live in an echo chamber, and all you listen to is what suits your agenda, then of course it's very easy to make you believe outrageous things that are demonstrably false. And all you have to do is say, well, you know, I understand what you're saying with these sources you're showing me to contradict me, but your sources are liberal media or something like that. You know, it's very easy to dismiss anything that doesn't fit the agenda, because all you have to do is discredit the source.
Exactly. I think the best way to analyze the whole thing is basically to say that what Donald Trump is doing, he's running a giant cult of personality. And the markers of cults that you go down the line, you say, okay, yeah, control of information, the echo chamber, that's very much part of the cult mentality. Mm-hmm. When you control the narrative, in fact, what's happening now is, I saw an article the other day where Trump's poll numbers had gone up because he's been able to set the narrative. He's rewriting history, saying, yeah, I was on top of this thing from day one. I never downplayed it. And Mike Pence went out and said, he's never minimized anything. None of this is true. It's all fake news. So he's got all these sycophants around him, just like a typical cult leader.
Yeah.
Go out and cover for him and rewrite the narrative, and people are buying it.
They are. And that we discuss things enough that he'll ask me, and I'm glad he does.
That's good.
What it blows my mind, because in the age of the internet, you can pull up things he's said and show people the video, and they'll still be like, nah, sorry. Yeah. He's been the best fake president news. Ever. Yeah. Yeah, and it's like, oh God, I don't get it, but I do, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, back when I was an evangelical, you know, I was all about voting Republican. I went to a George W. Bush rally. Mm-hmm. You know, there are pictures, there's evidence. I can't deny it.
Oh, yeah. You know, I went and saw Ronald Reagan.
Oh wow!
High school, man. We went to a Reagan rally in Seattle. So I was a young Republican. Further back than George Bush.
Yeah. But I think the difference is information wasn't as readily available then as it is now. But at the same time, you know, Donald Trump and others around him, they are not looking for critical thinkers. They're not looking for people who want to know more information. They're looking for people who want to hear a very specific message. Mm-hmm. And they're more than willing to give them that message, whether it's true or not. They're willing to say what needs to be said to remain in power.
That's why I've found it so important to study the cult psychology aspect of it. So when I'm looking at the Trump administration or evangelicalism, in a lot of ways, there's so many markers of cults, as you were saying, describing really. We both experienced them. I grew up in a fundamentalist cult. I grew up in the Bill Gothard movement, which was a total cult. It's still going on, even though he's not technically the leader of it. His name's all over the place. They use his materials, and they've got all sorts of front organizations going all over the world doing all sorts of shady stuff, man. I mean, and they're a full-on cult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it helps, I think, to disempower the indoctrination. It helps to be able to identify what it is that they did to us and say, okay, so this was the tactic that they used, and now I can name it, and that will sort of disempower it.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I think for me, it's also been important to accept that this was done to me. It wasn't something that just happened. It was done to me. Yeah. And that's been hard. I think, especially with still being so close with my parents, you know, in proximity, not having the safety of distance and so forth, you know, sometimes in my mind, I have to push away that, you know, this was an intentional thing that happened just so I can function with having them so close. But it was really important to finally accept that, yes, we were in a cult, but my parents and other people who I trusted kept me there. They put me there, and they kept me there, you know, for as long as they possibly could.
And they had the best of intentions, I think, in most cases. And that's what makes it so insidious, I think. Same with my parents. They absolutely believed they were doing the right thing. They themselves believed it. They took us to church. I mean, I'm like you. I was literally born in the church. I remember when I was a baby, I was probably a week old. I was in church, you know, straight out of the hospital, laying in my mom's lap in the pew. And that there I sat for the next, you know, 20 years. And then I
went
off to Bible college, you know. So I was in it from day one. And, you know, they weren't intentionally lying to us. The pastor wasn't preaching lies, you know, intentionally. They may not have done their due diligence, but it still happened to us, though.
Yeah.
We're still dealing with the after effects. What about that?
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. Just taking a short break to let you know what is coming up in the next few weeks here on Mindshift Podcast. I'm still looking forward to chatting with Catherine Stewart, author of The Power Worshippers. It's a book about the dangerous rise of Christian nationalism. This is a theme that we're going to be returning to here, talking about dominion theology, Christian reconstructionism, the politicization of evangelicalism in America, and what that all means. And this is something that should be of concern to you, whether or not you live in the United States of America, We're seeing that now, especially with the Trump administration, but the decisions he's making, fueled by a lot of the evangelical advisors that are all around him and his administration, have been really from the beginning. We're seeing their impact on his decisions around the coronavirus, denying of science, and all the rest of it. So this is something that should be of concern to you. I hope, too, speaking of the coronavirus, that you're staying safe, stay at home, maintaining your social distance, washing your hands, and keeping yourself safe. I hope, too, that you enjoyed the episode that I did, the bonus episode, really, with Janice Selby that came out just this week on Sunday. If you haven't heard that, you need to go back and listen to it. We talked about coping with anxiety and stresses and fears of all kinds as we're really beset on every side with a lot of anxieties, a lot of things to worry about, a lot of things to be concerned about. People are struggling financially. They're struggling to just stay sane, especially if they're working from home, they're self-isolating. So Janice was really good about providing good, helpful tips and resources on how to cope with the stresses and the anxiety of this really unprecedented time that we're living through right now, not just in America, of course, but all over the world. Here in the UK, we've been on complete lockdown. We're watching the news very carefully, and things are changing day by day, hour by hour. So we're trying to keep on top of it. But yeah, as I say, please stay safe. I hope you're enjoying this chat with Stephanie McCown, author of Raised Evangelical. I was going to say that at the end of the episode, I've got a special treat for you. One of the guys in our Mindshift Podcast Facebook group, one of our Patreon supporters, Daniel Moore, he posted up a song in our Facebook group that he had written and performed as we'd been having this discussion about dealing with our past, especially as you come out of evangelicalism like so many of us did, and Daniel does as well. And as I listened to his song, which is called On High, I thought, man, this really ties into what myself and Stephanie have been talking about and what we're going to continue talking about in the second half of this episode. So at the end of the show, I've got a special treat for you. I've got the song On High written and performed by Daniel Moore. So that's going to close out the show. Anyway, let's get on back into the chat with Stephanie McCown as we continue to explore this idea of how do you lose your faith and yet paradoxically find yourself.
I think it's hard to live in that tension between they didn't mean to do what they did, but they did do it.
We're still messed up.
Yeah. And it's hard for me personally, probably because I am still so entangled with them because I don't really have a choice right now. It's hard for me to not feel angry about that, you know, especially when I see the consequences. I mean, some of where I am in my life is because of circumstances. You know, I had cancer like 13 years ago, got pregnant the year after, divorced, became a single mother. I mean, I have had a whole lot of stuff happen in the last decade, like drug addiction, recovery. I mean, it's been one thing after another. So, you know, part of why I am where I am is because of the circumstances. I mean, it was just impossible to recover completely from one circumstance before the next thing came along. But a lot of that is also because, like when I had cancer, I, you know, this was 13 years ago and I wasn't quite out of evangelicalism just yet. I thought I was being punished because I'd had sex with my boyfriend. I'm like, oh my God, God must be so mad at me for that. And I mean, and then that was when I was really like, now hold on. God is so much going on and he cares about the fact that I'm having sex with my boyfriend. I don't think that's right. Yeah. Yeah. And so that was when the unraveling really began in earnest, because everything that I thought was true just fell apart so fast. And I thought, now there are horrible, horrible people in the world who do things much worse than having sex outside of marriage. And this, according to what I've been told, is what God cares about. That does not make sense. But what I also found was because I had never really been taught how to deal with adversity or anything other than read your Bible and pray about it, I was in no way equipped for what cancer did to my life. Because, you know, I had dealt with depression before and it took me a long time to get out on my own and get into a job I loved, an apartment I loved and everything. And just like that, all of that was gone. You know, because I couldn't go through treatments and keep working, so I couldn't afford my apartment, so I ended up moving back in with family. So everything was gone, just like that. And I was in no way equipped to deal with it. So, you know, that led to abusing the painkillers that I had been given. And it just led to years and years of struggling with medications and alcoholism. And, you know, then I finally, in 2013, detoxed, went through recovery, and learned how to really deal with adversity, not numb myself to it. But it was a learning process because I was never taught. And I think that's pretty typical of evangelicalism. It does not teach people how to deal with life outside of the evangelical bubble. Mm-hmm. You know,
you've got to have answers for everything.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I'm seeing right now with the coronavirus situation, which illustrates your whole story, that when these adversities happen to us, we have to, as Christians, we have to come up with some explanation. So
yeah.
All that shit happened to you because you had sex with your boyfriend and,
right.
You got punished. I mean, if that's the punishment for that act for mm-hmm. years of hell, that's unbelievable. If that's true.
Right.
If the coronavirus is punishment of the world for sin or homosexuality or abortion or whatever they say it is,
mm-hmm.
really? I mean, God's up there killing tens of thousands of people and for what? Is that what it, you know, and so they have to come up with some explanation for why these things are happening. And God's, but still has to be in control somehow.
Mm-hmm.
What a system.
Yeah, and I've noticed that too with the pandemic. You know, people are wanting answers, and the uncertainty, and that's when I refer to the rapture anxiety, because I think that if somebody has come out of that system and this is their first big crisis, that's got to be hard mm-hmm. because, you know, we were conditioned to have answers for everything. Even if the answers didn't really make sense, even if they made God seem like a monster, at least it was an answer,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I was always taught when the world gets, you know, when things in the world get really, really difficult, that means Jesus is coming back soon. So Jesus was coming back soon at least 10 times in my life.
Oh, yeah. He was always around the corner.
Right. But I'm thinking for anybody who is just experiencing that for the first time after leaving evangelicalism, that has to be a jarring experience, because I remember going through the cancer and then the alcoholism and the drug addiction and, you know, detox and everything. And I think it wasn't until I really detoxed, because I remember very clearly, I detoxed at home, which I do not recommend to anybody.
Wow.
Go to a facility and do it, because it's just safer for you. But I did that at home with the help of a couple medications my doctor gave me to get through it. And I did not read my Bible during detox. I read a book about the Scots-Irish in America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there was something transformative about that experience, because I read about these people who, you know, I don't know. It was just weird. You know, I was always taught in times of adversity to read your Bible and pray, and having experienced no help whatsoever from that, I read about people who, you know, were making moonshine and, bootlegging and all that. And that was that helped me. And I can't explain why, but it gave me a different perspective to look at entirely outside of everything I'd been taught. So I'm detoxing, I'm reading this book, and I came out the other side of detox completely done. I was just like, I cannot go back to that. I can't. It never served me well. And something about that week of hell as I was detoxing gave me a perspective that I did not have before. And I thought, you know, I'm okay without having answers. I'm okay without having to run to my Bible and run to my pastor and all of that. I don't need it.
You're far better off. I mean, look at all the stuff we've been describing. You know, imagine living your life as we did. On the one hand, you've got this satanic adversary. Okay, you've got the mm-hmm. devil prowling around like a roaring lion. You've got demons everywhere, spiritual warfare, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you've got this message that Jesus is coming back soon. And it could be at any moment. You never know when it's going to be. So on the one hand, you got Satan and his hordes of demons trying to tempt you and drag you down And then mm-hmm. you're living in this constant sense of anxiety that Jesus could be coming back at any point. And then, yeah. like you said, that's the rapture anxiety. No wonder Christians are so full of anxiety and depression. Yeah. And that's the hidden secret. There's so much of that within Christianity. But what mm-hmm. a toxic system. How yeah. can you live a normal life in terms of mental health? You cannot. Mm-hmm. I don't see how you can without just having all this cognitive dissonance. And you just smash it down by quoting Bible verses and mm-hmm. going down the loaded language route. You know, just Christianese, yeah. spout the verses and phrases, and that's yeah. how you get by.
Yeah, I think that all of that is just about numbing you good enough for now. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, I'm okay for now. It doesn't answer any questions for you. It doesn't really resolve anything. But for that moment, you can just be like, it just kind of pushes it aside because you have an answer. It doesn't matter there's if it's going to make sense.
As you say, yeah, it doesn't make sense. God's ways are higher than our ways. Well, look at again, the revealing stuff that we're seeing right now with the coronavirus, the Christian yeah. responses, it runs the gamut from, yes, this is judgment by God for sins of humanity, to all the way to, no, it's actually Satan. You know, I saw a thing with Kenneth Copeland just the other day where he's now rebuking Satan and demanding yep. that God put a stop to it. You know, so apparently it's Satan who's in charge of this thing and it's not God. And I mean, it's just insane. Yeah. If you take it to its logical conclusion, who's yeah. running the show here?
Right.
You know, we got to pray to stop it and all the rest of it. They're scrabbling around for some answer, some security, yeah. even though it doesn't make sense, as you say.
Yeah. And as much as they drive me crazy, because they do, mm-hmm. I also feel very sad for them, because I remember feeling that anxiety. You know, I remember when 9/11 happened and I was sure this is going to be the end. This is it. And I wasn't sure if I would be raptured. Or, I mean, I was terrified. And I think that when I see Christians doing things like putting the memes up or, you know, talking with my family about how this is God's judgment or whatever, I see fear because they really don't know what this is and they can't make sense of it. And I think there is a strong fear, whether they will admit it or not. What if I was wrong? Hmm. What if I'm not going to go to heaven? If Jesus comes back, what if I'm left behind? I mean, there's so much fear wrapped up into all of these theories people are throwing around because they are so desperate to get it right, because in their minds, the consequence of being wrong is horrifying. I mean, it's literally life and death.
Absolutely. Well, I was going to mention, that's exactly right. That's a good point. That's the other part of this horrific triangle. You got Satan and his demons. Jesus is coming back soon. But if he does come back, as you say, and you're not mm-hmm. worthy, you are going to be left behind. And yep. that, the implications of that are unbelievable. I mean, I remember as a kid doing the same thing you probably did, freaking out. You come home and your parents aren't home. That's yeah. it. They've been raptured. I've been left behind. Now I've got to face 7 years of tribulation.
Mm-hmm. You
know, it's so anxiety producing.
Yes.
So damaging.
It is. And I think about, you know, I've got like chronic illness and stuff now. My doctor thinks I have lupus because of the mm-hmm. pandemic. I haven't been able to get that confirmed or denied yet. But I wonder how much of that is the result of having lived a lifetime in fight, flight, or freeze mode. Yeah, you can't trauma. Live under that much stress all the time and not have long-term consequences for that.
Yeah. Well, it has physical impact on us. Talking to Marlene Winnell, she was saying that stress and trauma get stored in the body. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a mental, emotional reaction to stress and trauma. It's actually, it is stored in our bodies, and it does mm-hmm. have physical, physiological effects on us. So yeah, mm-hmm. you could be well reaping that kind of sad harvest of all those years of bullshit that you went through,
yeah.
a lot of it due to evangelicalism. Well, how have you recovered? How have you found yourself? Because your book says you lost your faith. So how have you reconstructed?
Well, I had to get really honest about a lot of things. You know, I think one of the biggest things, well, there's so many things, but, you know, once I got past all of the bullshit, and I had to, one thing I had to reckon with was my own choices. You know, I made a lot of choices that helped get me where I am. You know, And it's easy to look at that and say, oh my God, that was a whole string of really bad choices. It was a string of survival choices, you know, and I think that's important. Yeah, I think that's important to acknowledge, because I know that one thing I hear a lot from people who have left is there's a lot of chastising for choices we made before. I can't believe I did that. Yeah. That was so, you know, stupid or whatever.
Yeah, beating ourselves up.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, the fact that you're still here tells me there's a lot of strength there, and it needs to be acknowledged. You know, take credit for the fact that you saw your way through. You know, you held on. The amount of tenacity it takes to hang on when the very system that you look to for comfort and peace is also telling you you're a piece of shit every single day of your life. Yeah, the amount of tenacity. Yeah, you are a survivor. Really, I mean, you know, you're badass. So I had to flip the script, you know, because I could look at all the choices that I made that led to me renting from my parents, you know. But those were choices that were made with information I had at the time, and they were made to survive in a system that really, when you look at it honestly, is not made for survival. Mm-hmm. You know, your life is going to end one way or another. Either you're going to die and face God, or you're going to be raptured and face God, or you're going to be left behind and be martyred. You know, those are your options. Yeah. None of them are good. And so once I did that, things became easier. They're not easy by any means, but easier. Mm. I also had to get honest about my sexuality. I was never allowed to talk about that as a kid. I was always told, you know, if you're not cisgender and heterosexual, then you're an abomination. Mm-hmm. And so I was finally able, because I started getting honest about a lot of other things and looking at things realistically about how I was raised and how ridiculous it was to tell people that the thing God cares about the most is your sex life, you know, and talking with people who were not raised that way, I was finally able to accept, okay, I'm bisexual, you mm-hmm. know? And that was so liberating for me to finally be able to say that. Mm. and give all these feelings I've had for years a name. And anybody who's not familiar with that culture wouldn't be able to understand that. Like how could you not know? But when all you're taught is there's only one way to be, and anything other than that is evil, mm-hmm. it's really easy to convince mm-hmm. yourself that, you know, the way your heart flutters when you see that one person, mm-hmm. That's just your friend. You know,
you gotta suppress those feelings.
Yeah. And then I had to be real with myself about my parents. And that's hard. You know, I love my parents very much, but they did a lot of things that really hurt me. And getting real about that with myself, because I think even within ourselves, we can put a protective hedge around people we love, and we don't want to see that whether they meant to or not, they perpetuated harm for decades. And that harm had a lot of consequences for my life. And so I think being able to acknowledge that, and also to acknowledge that they're human, you know? And I think having my own child helped me with that part, because I do things all the time that I regret as I'm raising my son. Yeah. And so I think, yeah. And so I think, you know what? My parents did a lot of things that hurt me. I don't think it was their intention. I think that, as with most parents, they're doing the best they know to do at the time. Now, the fact that they're still in that mindset has also meant I have to get real about how much involvement I can allow them to have with my son. And I have to run interference constantly. And I have had to put, and this was very empowering in itself, putting a boundary down, especially with my father, because he was talking to my son about hell. And I'm like, you're not doing that. Not you know, my happen. Son was, no, he was only 4. And he said to me, Mom, I'm having some bad dreams. And I'm like, well, what's going on? And he told me that Papa told me if I don't serve Jesus, I'm going to burn in hell forever. And I was, wow. It broke my heart for him. And then I was just furious with my father. Mm. And I had to tell him, you know, if you're going to be talking to my son about those things, then you can't be alone with him. You can't, because you're hurting him. And so these are all relatively small things, you know, but they're huge.
Add up. Yeah. You put them all together.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, it sounds like being real and being honest with yourself, it comes with a potential great cost though, doesn't it? Because then you've got to say, all right, what are the implications of coming out? And what are the implications of telling my parents that they cannot talk to my son this way, even though you're living under their roof? That's got to be so incredibly difficult. I don't know how you survive, to be honest with you, because that's a big issue that we hear a lot from people who family members are still in whatever the religion that they've left or the cult, that they will not respect those boundaries. And they constantly do this passive aggressive thing where they just continually go over those boundaries, and you have to reinforce it and reinforce it. You've got to be the bigger person. And yet you don't want to lose the relationship.
Right.
So it's incredibly difficult.
It is. It's a balancing act. And I think that, you know, when I think about finding myself, I think that what I mainly found is the strength to assert who I am and to assert what I will tolerate and what I will not. Because when I was an evangelical, I tolerated a lot. I let people walk all over me because, you know, we're told we're supposed to be servants and we're supposed to prefer others ahead of ourselves and
be submissive.
All of that. And so leaving evangelicalism, a big part of finding my truest self is recognizing that I'm actually a really strong person and that I have the right to feel safe in my own home. I have the right to say, this is the boundary. You're not going to cross it. And if you do, there will be consequences. I mean, that's a right we all have, you know, and I was never taught that. So that has been extremely empowering. And that has really been helpful in really finding my true voice and finding my truest self when I'm not trying to be what they told me I have to be. You know, I knew from a very, very young age that I was never going to be the kind of woman they wanted me to be. I knew that from a very young age. But rather than seeing that as just part of who I am, I saw it as a flaw. And I saw it as something that needed to be fixed. And I tried for a very long time to be that person. You know, I grew my hair. My head is shaved now because I just am done with hair for a while. But for a long, you know, I would grow my hair long. I would, you know, try to wear dresses as often as I could, tried to be this meek, mild person that they told me I needed to be a good Christian woman. And I just never fit the mold ever. And for most of my life, I felt like that meant something was wrong with me. And it's only been within the last few years that I've seen that as a strength, not as a weakness, not as something I need to fix.
Suppressing that element of your personality is so damaging.
It is.
It cannot be healthy to say, as you say, this is not a strength. It's actually a flaw. It's a problem that I have to eradicate with God's help, which is another avenue down, you know, that you got to go down as well. Jesus is going to help you become that perfect woman, whatever.
Yeah.
In Christ. Well, listen, I need to let you go because in about 2 minutes here, there's going to be so much noise that we're not going to be able to talk. All my neighbors are going to go out banging pots and pans to salute all the essential workers here in Wales. So I'm afraid that it's going to blow out our recording. But just quickly before we go, how can people get a hold of you? Where is the best place to find you and where can they get a hold of your book?
My book is on Amazon. It's available in Kindle and in paperback. And I am on Twitter quite a lot at Stephanie Mick, that's M-I-C-K, 75. And you can find me there and interact with me. Tell me I'm full of shit or whatever you say. You know? I get that a lot. So bring it.
You want to encourage people to do that,
No, no, I'm just teasing. But that's where you can find me. I am on Facebook, but I'm not on there very often. And I'm I've still got a lot of evangelicals I'm friends with over there because they're family. So you're not going to get my truest self over there. I'm a lot nicer over there.
Sound like Twitter is the best place to find you.
It is. Now.
And go, yeah. Go look up your book. What I'll do is I'll put a link to your book as well on the show notes. So if people want to click on that, they can find your book on Amazon as well. So thank you so much, Stephanie. I've had an absolutely fantastic time talking to you, getting to know you a little bit.
Yeah.
I think we're going to try to work on you, hopefully get you back for our Mind Shift podcast Zoom call. We'll see if you want to drop in and be the guest. That would be absolutely fantastic.
That'd be fun.
I know people would love to meet. In fact, one of our gals in our group, she left a review on your Amazon page, I noticed. So really cool. So we've already got a connection there. So
looking, I'm checking something really quick because I often give out the wrong Twitter handle. Okay, Stephanie Mix 75. Okay.
That was correct. You know your own Twitter handle.
I do. Well, I just changed it because I'm like, my old one sounded really dumb. Like, if people are going to be looking at my page, I should probably, you know,
I need a cooler Twitter handle.
Yeah. Well, it's been great being here. Thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
Thank you, Stephanie. Take care. I'll speak to you soon.
Okay. Bye.
Tell me something I know. Awaken all those memories. I just need some solace in the story we are telling. Feed me with your prize. Rock me with those words from on high. I won't ask any questions because I'm not meant to know. Feed me with your and foundations. On solid ground we rise up. The end of days is coming, but I just need some caffeine. Feed me with your prize. Rock me with words from on high. I won't ask any questions because I'm not meant to know. Feed me with your light. Rising up, oh, it's rising up, the story.